Vulture's Garden, music by Art Jarvin and our guest here on Calvos and Damien. You got so many sides in the music that you do, and let's turn to an improvisational side.
Okay.
I'm always surprised every time, because you got us a pack of CDs, and we started listening to them, and we kept saying, yeah, but that one's different. We want to put this guy in a box, and this is not working very well.
Yeah, that doesn't work very well.
No. So tell us, if you will, about your improvisation, how you came by it, since you seem to have come by your composition, how they say honestly, as opposed to out of a school of composition where you studied.
Yeah, you know, I went through a long period of writing chamber music that was meticulously composed and documented in notation, and hard to learn and takes a lot of rehearsal, and, you know, it's supposed to be pretty much the same every time, you know, ideally, you know, composition in the classical sense that term. And I'm always, you know, looking as I go through my life and my composition career, I like to say I'm looking for ways to stay interested. And that's one of the reasons I think it's been, you know, a little difficult for me to establish myself career-wise, as it might be if I had, like, found my style or found my voice and just kind of stuck with it. You know, like, that's what I do. I write a cappella vocal music and on religious texts, and that's my work. But, you know, I've just never been that way. I get interested in something and I pursue it vehemently, I'm project-based very much. And so after years of that kind of fussy composition, I just felt it was, you know, time for a change of direction. And I had started out doing a lot of improvisation in, you know, my college days, and hadn't done much of it since. So at the time, which is around, you know, the late 90s, I decided to start an ensemble, which I called Sum Over History. And I picked a few of my friends that
I had
worked with.
Sum Over History.
And I got more into improvisation as a way of making music. Not free improvisation. I've really not done a lot of that, although I have had at least one group in recent years that we never worked out pieces. We always just went on stage and played. But I was more interested in bringing my compositional skills and sensibility to improvisation and putting the two together. So I would rehearse various kinds of games or structures or ideas, you know, that would allow me to do music that I could call pieces. You know, this is Edges, or this is, you know, Bones and Drums. Mm-hmm. And it would be pretty much the same piece every time, although there was no music written on the page. Mm-hmm. So what I think we'll play now is a solo piece, you know, not for that ensemble. It's a piece I wrote for myself, but it's from that period of getting more into composition, playing a much, much, much greater role in the piece. And No Blues is specifically a piece I wrote kind of in response to the death of my father, who coincidentally died in the same year that my friend Randy Hostetler did, who we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, I felt that the most positive thing I could do in response was, rather than grieve, which of course you're going to do in the loss of a friend or a father, is try to take some of that grieving energy and direct it positively into something that would be a little more celebratory or a little more, a more pleasant way to remember someone, rather than just keeping in your own thoughts. Get some of that out in terms of music and make something that, you know, something you would enjoy listening to as a way of remembering someone. And my father, the last conversation I had with him, he had gotten back into, you know, playing harmonica quite a bit and was toying with the idea of getting a chromatic. And he knew I played chromatic harmonica. Mm. And he was wondering, now, you know, is this going to be too hard for me? You know, is it hard to play? You know, do you think I should get a chromatic? So I was all set to take one of my chromatic harmonicas and send it to him to help him get started on that. And he died before I got around to doing that. But he started me in music without really meaning to, in that when we were little kids, you know, or when I was a little kid, he bought all the kids in the family. We were on a summer vacation. He bought us all harmonicas. we went into some music store and he wanted to get a harmonica for himself, I think. And so he bought all of us like a Hohner old standby.
Yeah.
And so I got my first musical instrument from my dad, and it was a harmonica, which he also dabbled in. And so in trying to come up with a musical response to, you know, losing him, I thought, well, I'll write a harmonica solo. And it's called No Blues, partly because, you know, I got into playing harmonica mainly to play blues. And he was not a blues musician. Mm-hmm. I mean, he played more, you know, church songs and folk tunes and things like that. Oh, Susanna, that kind of thing. And also just No Blues being a way of saying, you know, it's like, no, this is a positive statement. This isn't about grief now. This is about one of the best memories I have of my dad, or the best connections I had to him, because we were not very close in many other ways. But we had no issues or animosity either. But in thinking back, what's the best thing he did for me? Well, okay, he didn't teach me how to fish, but he did sort of set me on the road to my musical life, you know, through the harmonica.
And what kind of instrument are you playing here?
On that particular recording, I believe that's something they don't make anymore. It's probably a Hohner CBH Chamber Huang, the Chinese harmonica virtuoso, designed a beautiful chromatic harmonica, four-octave concert instrument, mm-hmm. Which Hohner sold for a while, and I got one shortly after they quit making them. That's probably what I'm using on that recording. And then a little bit of...
For our listeners, explain how a chromatic harmonica differs in how it's made and how it's used from the standard harmonica. Everybody knows sort of the standard harmonica. You play up and down a
major scale,
and you inhale and you exhale, and that's right. What you get.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. The harmonica that most people hear most of the time, even in the hands of some real flashy player playing in, what's that guy, Blues Travel or something. I mean, that guy's doing a lot of hot licks, but he's doing it all on a diatonic harmonica mm-hmm. that really only plays, you know, in one key.
Right, you can bend the notes by how you force the air through it, but that's about it.
Yeah, and on a chromatic harmonica, which is the kind of thing you'd hear someone like Toots Thielman or the great, you know, virtuoso from the 50s, Larry Adler,
those
guys are playing a chromatic harmonica, which with the aid of a little button on the side that you press, you can get from the instrument all the notes of the chromatic scale, just like on a piano or a saxophone. So it means you don't have to play just in one key.
Right. It's got they'll have reeds in them, and this kind of slides over the airway to the other set of reeds.
It actually brings you into another set of reeds. Yeah. It's an instrument that you can, in a sense, kind of tune on the fly, just mm-hmm. like a harp, where you change the pedals and it changes the key of the instrument temporarily. So, and it has a different sound. They're usually bigger and they're less flexible, so you don't hear chromatic players doing as much bending, mm-hmm. although I tend to beat the crap out of it from time to time. But, you know.
Our guest is Art Jarvin, and here on, by the way, we haven't said it, Calvos and Damien in the house.
In the house.
Yeah, you bet. Here it is. No Blues. Art Jarvin.
Thank you.
Music by Arthur Jarvinen, improvisation on chromatic harmonica.
Yeah, largely improvised. Yeah. I mean, obviously that, you know, there's a structure to it. You know, when Oh Susanna comes in, it's, you know,
sure,
a chosen moment for that to happen and a target to lead up to throughout the piece. And also that that little theme gets built up to. I mean, so there are definitely composed materials that are, you know, target points within the improvisation. And then the idea of establishing those drones with the digital delay hold button, you know, playing, grabbing a note and then playing over that as a drone and then establishing another drone. So the piece was worked out, but the moment-by-moment detail of what licks I'm actually playing was improvised.
Well, you did mention something about the free improvisation completely. It was sort of not in your repertoire or not in your real personal style. Let's sort of shift topics a little bit. Mm-hmm. While we were listening to the piece, we're also talking about a mutual acquaintance of ours by the name of John Truby. John is, of course, a guest on our show, and we've known John Truby for an inordinately long time, almost embarrassingly long, since we first heard his band at the Delaware Valley Festival of the Avant-Garde in 1974 in Trenton, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And where did you meet him, and how did you work with John?
Well, I was in California. This is probably around 1980 or 81, either just finishing up or having just finished up my, you know, graduate studies at Cal Arts. And I was very, very good friends and, you know, classmates, colleagues with M.B. Gordy, the drummer, percussionist. And he was very close friends with bass player Jack Vies, who's now based in New Haven, teaching at Yale. So Jack and M.B., had both been working, they had worked together a lot in Glassboro, New Jersey when they were students there.
Uh-huh.
And they came out to California around the same time. And I met Jack through MB. And it turns out they were both, had started working with Truby a little bit, who at that time was already out in Los Angeles.
Right.
And the album that they worked on was The Communists Are Coming to Kill Us.
Absolutely. Gray and, cover with the power lines.
Yeah. And so I met Truby through MB and Jack. And when John started his next project, you know, with the Ugly Janitors of America, he invited me to be in the group. So I used the name Bars Carmichael and played marimba with the Ugly Janitors. And at that time, I think that's about when MB was getting too busy. So I don't think I ever played with Truby with MB on drums. MB had kind of moved on to other projects, but... I had other, you know, friends who were playing in the group.
What was the Truby experience like?
Because it's a pain in the ass. he does everything absolutely the wrong way. You know, he doesn't know how to rehearse a band. He just assumes that he counts a lot on people's goodwill towards him. You know, so he invites all these people to be in the band, assuming that if he invites 20 people to be in the band, at least 10 of them will show up to each of the two or three rehearsals, and then it'll be okay because by the time we go on stage, some of the people will actually have been to some of the rehearsals, and the ones who haven't will pick it up as they go, you know? So it's just absolutely the half-assed way to put together a project, you know? And that's how he does it. It's the only way he knows, I guess. It never occurred to him that you could actually ask dependable people to be in your group, and then you could insist that they do things like learn the music and show up. So I found it enormously frustrating to work with him, but very rewarding and fun, or I wouldn't have done it more than once.
Yes, exactly.
Because I just love John, and, you know, there's a high amusement quotient in his work.
Sure.
And, you know, he's a good musician. He just, I have different, let's say, shall we say, a different philosophy of how to actually manage a project.
Circle. So one day we'll tell the story of how John Truby and Nick Didkovsky and Larry Polansky all somehow came together in circles and never in one place.
It's a vicious circle.
Oh, it was. It was that.
I may have the largest collection of John Truby original artwork. I'm not sure.
You don't.
Oh, okay.
I do.
Oh, okay, you do. Well, I have a
including
pretty large
bags of candy bar wrappers.
Yeah. Because what happened, he gave me an original drawing And he came over to, like, John doesn't do a lot of, like, socializing, but I do quite a lot of entertaining. And so I had a party with a lot of people at my house, and Truby actually showed up. And he gave me, well, he walked into the kitchen and he said, "You really like Beefheart, right?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm a huge Beefheart fan." He goes, "No, I mean, you really, really like Beefheart, right?" I said, "Well, how many times can I say it? John, you know, I love Beefheart." And then he opened the bag and he had brought me a Beefheart. That was his idea of, you know, amusing pun. I guess he felt he should bring something to the party, you know, like a potluck or whatever. So he brought a Beefheart. But anyway, he noticed that the drawing he had given me was on my wall, along with lots of other original artwork. And he was so impressed that anyone actually would put his artwork on the wall where people could see it, that, you know, a few days later in the mail, I got this huge envelope full of Truby drawings. Like, I don't have enough walls in my house to put all these things on, you know. And he has sent me even more in the, you know, more recent years.
His famous pen and ink drawings was heavy on the black. And,
yeah, heavy on the black. Mm-hmm. And in our music studio in my house, I used to have on the wall until recently a Truby drawing that had, you know, some grotesque figure with like one huge eyeball hanging out, you know.
Oh, you have the original of that.
The original of that.
I want that.
And on it, it says, "You are unacceptable by the standards which we have established." And I thought that was really good to hang in the studio right where my wife's cello students can see it while they're taking their lessons.
We're talking about John Truby, but the guest is Arthur Jarvinen. So let's get back to you and this album here, this CD. Tell us about this and what can we play for it and who are you in this and why?
Okay.
It's called Sergeant Pecker.
Well, obviously it's a kind of parody, a loving parody of the Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album by the Beatles, usually referred to as Sergeant Pepper. I don't even remember exactly how I got into doing this project. I think that I had written some material or stumbled across some material that I, you know, just playing around at the piano or whatever, and I came up with some kind of progression that just sounded so much like the Beatles, just absolutely so much like the Beatles, that I started thinking in terms of, well, this could be a Beatles song. Maybe I should actually turn it into like a fake Beatles song. And somehow, you know, just dots got connected. It's been too long. I can't really remember the specifics of just how it occurred to me, I am going to write this album. But this was also when I was starting to get tired of spending thousands and thousands of dollars of my own money or trying so hard to raise grant money to pay for recordings, that I wanted to just create my own modest home studio and see if I could make a whole album for free, basically. So these two ideas kind of coalesced, and I started writing Beatles songs, or either fake Beatles songs that would sound just like they could have been Beatles songs.
Yes.
Or direct parodies of specific Beatles songs.
Yes.
Although Sergeant Pecker is more like original stuff that is my stuff sounding like it could be the Beatles.
Yes.
But there's, you know, quite a few tunes where, you know, you wouldn't even have to guess, you know, what song I'm mimicking. And I think I've done a good job of walking a very fine legal line before it becomes...
Yes, and also in some respects a kind of a social line.
Yeah. But so the project, once I really conceived it and was consciously working on a full CD-length album of Beatles-like material called Sergeant Pecker, I decided in the interest of doing it for free, that I would do it at home, recording on the computer, direct to hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
I would do all of the live parts, which is almost exclusively vocals, except for the song Black Guy, where I'm playing National Steel guitar. Everything else is done using general MIDI. I composed and arranged the tunes using Sibelius software, playing back general MIDI samples of all the instruments, so it sounds really cheesy. And it's supposed to be that way. And I figured that was appropriate for two reasons. One, I could do it for free. I only spent $200 on that record, and that was because I had to buy the Audiophile 2496 digital recording card for my computer. So that was the only expense involved. And because it is a parodistic album, it's supposed to be humorous, I figured it'd be perfectly fine to do all these lush orchestrations with, you know, French horns and various kinds of organ and piano and trumpets and French horns and recorders and everything, all done the cheesiest possible way.
Well described. What can we play safely? Let's choose a couple.
Play the very first one, Taller Than Jesus.
And one other one. Let's play two.
Well, what's second on there?
Whiteness.
Yeah, those are both good. Just playing back to back. Or you could do Yellow Limousine.
Yellow Limousine. Okay, yeah, let's do that. Taller Than Jesus and Yellow Limousine.
Yeah, those are good.
Our guest is Art Jarvinen.
I think we get the idea. Can we move on to something else?
Just keep rolling. I got lots more.
Oh boy.
Step on it, Lickert. Full speed ahead.
Lee Harvey Oswald once had a ride in my yellow limousine. Lee Harvey Oswald once had a ride in my yellow limousine. Harvey Oswald once had a ride in my yellow limousine. In my yellow limousine. The Dalai Lama and the shabby runner, frequent riders in my yellow limousine. The Dalai Lama and the shabby runner, frequent riders in my yellow limousine. The Dalai Lama and the shabby runner, frequent riders in my yellow limousine. In my yellow limousine.
Aren't you glad we changed the name of this show?
Now, you see, why do people have such a problem with MIDI playback? I think that was just lovely.
It was charming, absolutely charming. Yes, made me want to run for my cough drops. Our guest is Art Charvinen, our third Yarvinen, in my first rendering of his name years ago. And that was from Sergeant Pecker.
Yes.
It was a deliberate, aside from the kind of gentle tribute to the Beatles, was it sort of a deliberate attempt to be as politically incorrect as possible as you went through some of the songs?
No, and it didn't start out, you know, intentionally. It was not my intention from the beginning to make the album as filthy as it was. It just sort of started as I wrote song after song and started piecing it together as an album. I realized that I had fallen into, unconsciously, kind of at some point, fallen into developing these characters, these personae. And so in a sense, even though I've never written an opera, every composer likes to sort of think that they have. And Sergeant Pecker would probably be like my opera, if you will, because you do have the four characters. Jean Paul Fab, you know, the two John Pauls, who are the leaders of the group and undisputed the better songwriters.
And who all go by, you know, as the different composers and lyricists
And Odd Man Out, you know, is the rhythm guitarist or lead guitarist, and, you know, another singer-songwriter in the group who functions kind of independently. And then there's Otto DeFe, you know, the drummer. And it turns out that Otto has discovered these compromising photos of the two John Pauls and is basically blackmailing his way on into a higher profile on the album, you know, more of his songs. And it turns out that he's got a particularly disagreeable personality. He's just one nasty character and a very puerile and filthy sense of humor. And they can't really, the others are embarrassed about it, but they can't really do that much about it because he's got this, you know, he's got something hanging on him, you know, which is these compromising photos. So it does have a sort of very loose underlying kind of plot or rationale to, you know, that sort of thread that holds the album together.
I think in the writing business we call that the excuse.
Yeah, the excuse, I guess. So in a sense, I would say it's more of an opera than a lot of what I hear other colleagues of mine getting away with calling opera. I mean, some people have operas that don't even have singing in them.
Never heard that.
So it did sort of start to take on a semblance of a story with characters who have relatively consistent personalities. And also the structure of the album, you know, it's even though it's called Sergeant Pecker, it's very more consciously and deliberately based as made as a parody of the White Album, in a lot of ways. But and Abbey Road too. It's really, you know, my favorite Beatles stuff is the later Beatles. Unlike most people who seem to, you know, think they sort of deteriorated, and that Sergeant Pepper is like the pinnacle, and then the later albums aren't as good. I tend to really like the White Album, Abbey Road. Those are the only Beatles records that I actually had on vinyl.
I don't remember that far.
I smell a tour coming.
Yeah.
Do you? What kind of tour?
Well, a Pecker tour.
Pecker tour. Yeah.
It'd make a good black box production. I think it could be staged.
Do you happen to realize that a person that we mentioned before, Brian Johnson, is the manager of a black box theater in Burlington, Vermont?
Well, that's good to know. Yeah, I actually have thought about that and even have contacts to some people that I've been thinking about maybe presenting it to or proposing it to specifically. Because I think you could take the album Sergeant Pecker and do it as a black box production that would then become almost like a parody of the movie Let It Be, where they're in the studio recording the album. You could be, you know, the black box stage set could be the studio and this album is being made. And so you'd hear the whole album over the course of the production, but all the little dialogues and the guy in the booth talking about, you know, I'll pull those faders.
And how would you play all those roles at once?
I wouldn't.
Oh.
If that were to be staged, well, actually, that hadn't occurred to me. I could actually do it and play all the roles, probably. But I always, in having this idea that, oh, this could be staged, I just immediately went to, it would be a small group of people with a lot of CD playback for the backing tracks and so forth. But I could even do it as a one-man show, I'll bet.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that, and that's probably realistic.
You'd need a lot of hats.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot of hats.
Hats, yeah. You came here with a hat.
Nice hat right here.
Yes.
Yeah. And I have others.
Yes, you have. It looks like it. What do you say? How would you describe that?
Outback. I think it's an Outback hat?
Outback bonnet.
Yes, a bonnet. 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 His
We're talking to Art Jarvinen today. He's in the house with Calvos and Damien. And what are your plans? Where are you going? And musically, and I don't think we've ever heard a large ensemble piece of yours.
I tend to write for pretty small ensembles. You know, my chamber music and so forth tends to be kind of ear unit size because, you know, for 18 years I was in the California ear unit and wrote a lot of pieces for that ensemble specifically, or for subgroups of that ensemble, or that group with its various doublings. And a few, you know, commissions that I've gotten over the years have been, like, I got a commission for the New York New Music Ensemble. I got a commission for an L.A. contemporary group called Extet. That's what I, as a player, what I like to be a part of is, you know, small ensembles. I'm probably one of the few composers, you know, around who just has no interest at all in the orchestra. I mean, if you threw $35,000 at me and said, we need a 10-minute orchestra piece from you, I'd come up with one.
Listeners, please.
How about MIDI? Orchestral MIDI.
Yeah. Orchestral MIDI, yes.
Orchestra music is not something I listen to. There's not a lot of orchestra pieces, even by my favorite composers, that I particularly like. I mean, I like the late Beethoven string quartets and would listen to those, but I wouldn't bother to put on a Beethoven symphony. It's just, the music sounds weird to me. The orchestra sounds anachronistic. It sounds odd, it sounds overdone, and I like the intimacy and the clarity of chamber music and smaller resources. So that's why you don't hear a lot of big pieces from me, although I've certainly written a lot of big pieces if you're talking about length as a bigness factor.
Oh, yeah. We certainly are aware of that with the Immobilities tune, the 24 hours.
Large scale works. I just don't tend to. And again, you know, it's like, that's what a lot of the commissions and what a lot of the funding is for. You know, in the States, we seem to really still want to preserve the orchestra. And most composers I know, if they, you know, you gave them a bunch of money and said you can write whatever you want and get it played, I mean, I think the majority of American composers would leap at the opportunity to write an orchestra piece because, you know, you just
I think it's fun, of course. You know, I've written a dozen of them, and most of them have been actually performed. Yeah. And I like it because it's like, you know, you're constantly playing in and out of the choirs of the orchestra. Here, there's a little bit here, and then you're constantly talking back and forth. And then you can do enormous layers, and I love layers. Where things are hidden, buried inside, that, you know, 20 listenings later, you say, oh, wait, that's in there. Look, and, you know, that's my fascination with it, you know, but I've been fascinated from the beginning with it. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a late coming thing, and nobody ever threw any money my way. How about you? They threw any money your way?
I'm still waiting.
Well,
check is in the mail, so I heard in 1990.
Yeah, that's right. We still have some royalties due, don't we?
Oh, well.
Never mind. So where are you going? What's your plans?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I keep looking, you know, from time to time for ways to stay interested instead of continuing. Well, I can do 10 more of those kinds of pieces, but I've done 10. So what's the next thing? So for the last 5 years or so, I've immersed myself very, very heavily into the world of surf rock and developed a whole online project called The Invisible Guy, a real soundtrack for an imaginary spy film. And I wrote 50 episodes that are, each one is a scene. So it's basically a short story, a, you know, written text, narrative, and a piece of music to go with each scene. And those are all online at invisibleguy.com. Mm-hmm. That's a 50-installment website that's been up for the last couple of years, and is just going to live online for as long as I can foresee.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of that project, I really started looking around for, well, okay, what's, I'm tired of surf music now. What's the next thing? And when you do 4 or 5 years of surf music, it makes it hard to apply for commissions and grants, or, you know, apply for a Guggenheim, because they want to see like recent work, and that means not surf music. So I made a conscious choice to write some more instrumental chamber music, uh-huh. just, you know, to have current work. So this fall I wrote a percussion solo and a 15-minute piece for a recorder trio. So three soprano recorders.
Three soprano. Oh, that's. Did you play with the resulting tones in that?
No, but they happen anyway. If you got three soprano recorders playing in unison or playing out of phase the same kinds of material, you're gonna just through that process naturally get a lot of interesting clashing of sonorities in a register on an instrument that's, you know, out of tune anyway. So you're gonna get, you know, I sent it to a recorder player that I don't know personally, but doing some online research, I figured I'd send the piece to Vicky Beckman. And she wrote back. She was very intrigued by the piece, which is called Percy Grainger Fans the Muse. And she wrote back and said, I'm very intrigued by this piece, but does it really have to be for three soprano recorders? Because my teeth are already gritting just thinking about
truth.
That. So that one hasn't been played. And I think it could be done satisfactorily on three tenors, for example. But I really would like to hear it on sopranos. So I wrote that, and then I wrote in memory of my friend and colleague and former teacher, Stephen Lucky Mosco, who died about 2.5 years ago. I had wanted to write a piece in memory of him, and so over the Christmas break this past year, I wrote a 40-minute string quartet called 100 Cadences with 4 Melodies, a Chorale, and Coda with Bells on. And that has yet to be premiered also, but that's... I've written a bunch of, you know, more conventional chamber music again. And I also recently finished a project based on the poetry of Charles Bukowski, a piece called Ordinary Madness, Musicians Meet Bukowski. So I wrote 6 pieces based on Bukowski poems, and 3 other composers, Amy Knowles, Mark Lowenstein, and Martin Herman, also wrote installments for that, and that was recently premiered at Red Cat in Los Angeles. And the new direction that I'm just starting to go in now, the very next thing I want to do is I want to get involved in doing some field recording. I put together a little kit, nice little case with, you know, foam in there to protect my Zoom H4, you know, handheld recorder.
Yep.
And I've got a beautiful little digital camera that's, you know, tiny, the Canon SD1000, and I've got spare batteries in there and some earbuds, so now I can go anywhere in Vermont with this little purse over my shoulder and get studio quality recordings and photo documentation of my sites. So the other evening I recorded some Vermont rain and some birds at dawn, and one of these evenings, maybe even tonight, I'm going to go kayaking out on Caspian Lake with my recorder and record some kayaking on Vermont water.
You've missed the peepers this year.
Yeah, though. Well, you can't record everything.
They're definitely.
But this is a brand new area for me, just recording as a kind of composition. And I think that's a direct outgrowth of something I got into a couple of years ago, which is shortwave listening. And I got a beautiful handmade one-tube regenerative shortwave receiver made by a guy in, where is he based? St. Louis, Missouri. A guy named Larry Nauman. Makes these homemade shortwave radios and sells them on eBay. I've bought 7 of them.
Wow.
And when I listen to shortwave, very shortly after starting that kind of activity, I started listening to it as if with a sort of in the state of mind that what I'm listening to is a composition. So as I tune the dials and I find something interesting, I just assume I'm listening to music. And so I'm developing this kind of way of listening, which is like listening as composition.
Sort of a post-classical Kurzweil, the kind of Stockhausen thing.
Yeah. So that's a new direction, is just the way I listen. Because, you know, I hardly ever listen to music anymore in terms of putting on a CD and listening to it. That rarely happens in my life. It's been years since I was an active, like, listener. I've never used background music. And sitting down and listening to recordings, going to live concerts. It's rare that I do that. So to stay interested, I write my own music. I've developed an attitude towards listening, that listening itself is composition. And I'm developing a new group. We've only performed once, but I'm hoping to keep working with a man named Lewis Keller, who I met he was a grad student at CalArts, and he's one of these laptop gurus who does a lot of interesting things with Max MSP and robotics and things like that. So we did a performance under the name The Baghdad Batteries, where Lewis does his laptop manipulation of sound kind of thing, and I feed him the signals to work with. So my instruments are shortwave radios, Geiger counter, spoken word, things like that that aren't really thought of as instruments per se, but that make interesting signals. And I provide those to him who does the manipulation, and together we come up with these compositions. And again, it's very improvisatory, but like what we were saying, you know, with some of my other projects, we don't go on stage and just play. We go up on stage with some plans.
With a plan. And,
you know, yeah, with a plan. Things that we consider pieces.
You didn't have any trouble traveling with this group with your name and the equipment.
Well, we haven't traveled. We played once in Los Angeles. And the Baghdad Batteries are very beautiful things. Do you know what they are? They're artifacts that were discovered near Baghdad in 1927 or 29. Somebody unearthed these clay jars, which have these stoppers in them and this metal rod. I mean, they are batteries. As far as we can tell, a clay, you know, jar that's got a copper rod down in the middle of it and a copper sticking out the top with a sealed in there and traces of some sort of acidic material on the insides of the jar, it's a storage battery. It's a galvanic cell.
Wow.
And they discovered a handful of these things in Baghdad or near there. So, and they're known now as the Baghdad Batteries. And so given the nature of the electronic work I'm doing with Lewis, it just seemed like a cool name. And he said, well, you realize, of course, we may be politicized for the name. And I just can't be concerned about things like that. You've got a cool name like the Baghdad.
Oh, yeah, it's a great name.
And it refers to some real thing that actually is a very interesting and fascinating historical discovery. I mean, archaeological discovery. We can't imagine or actually make up our minds what the, you know, ancient, you know, people who made these things would have used them for. We can only speculate.
I was just struck by what it would be like to fly these days with a pile of equipment and a name like that.
Yeah, weird equipment like Geiger counters and homemade, you know, electronics.
Oh, yeah.
And we're the Baghdad Batteries.
Oh, sure you are.
Sure you are.
Step
yes.
right this way. Right. We have some protrusion devices for you.
For sure, yeah.
When you were talking about that recorder trio, I was reminded that we have a recording here of a piece for three oboes, which explores some of that microtonal kind of feel, especially toward the beginning.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the kind of the resulting tones because of that. So tell me a little bit about
the piece
Crows.
Is called A Conspiracy of Crows.
Yeah.
And to me, one of the intriguing things about this piece is that over the course of its 20 minutes, the three oboes are playing such a fascinating range of, you know, odd timbres, weird things that sound almost like they were meticulously composed, beautiful random textures, microtones, multiphonics, all kinds of, you know, the complexity of the sound of the piece and the kind of richness of texture and timbre and so forth. I could never have composed, and literally there is not one single sonority in the piece that was deliberately selected or chosen by me for any musical or compositional reasons. All I did was come up with a mindlessly simple progression of numbers, which is just the 20th century, 1900, 1901, 1902, 1903, all the way up to 1999, and assigned each digit from 0 through 9 to one of the fingers that an oboe player uses to play the oboe. And it was a short step from there to just produce 400 fingering diagrams with absolutely no thought whatsoever to what comes out of the oboe when you blow into it with your fingers in that position. So it's all just a sort of, it's my most Cagean piece in that it's using a kind of completely unpredictable, well-organized on some, I mean, there is this progression of numbers. So there are recurring motifs as the, you know, zero is always a reset. So as you go through 1900, 1901, 1902, 1903, there is a logic to the way the fingers are moving and the kinds of fingering diagrams that are being produced, but no intention or even no concern on my part as to what comes out of the oboe as a result. So it's very Cagean in that I couldn't predict the results that I
had. Had you not said any of that, mm-hmm. however, it would still have been a piece of an acoustic substance. Mm-hmm. I love the sound of this piece. Yeah. I don't care how you got there.
Yeah.
You know, that's I was so taken by it.
Yeah. So I just think it's one of my most successful pieces, and you know, kind of unique in that it does rely so heavily on non-intention on my part.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear part of the opening mm-hmm. movement of this. This is Catherine Pissarro playing all three oboes and overdubbing.
Yes.
Yes. Music by Art Jarvinen, A Conspiracy of Crows. Art Jarvinen's our guest. That was an excerpt from a piece for three oboes entitled A Conspiracy of Crows with Catherine Pizarro playing all three in overdubbing. Take us out. We got one short piece coming up. Tell us the importance of flight, of philosophy and weather.
Repetition and variation.
There you go.
Is my philosophy of music, I guess. At least has a lot to do with my personal techniques and styles. And weather. I've been in Southern California for 30 years, since 1978, and I'm in the process of trying to move to Vermont, of all crazy things. And people warn me about the winters, but I spent days of my youth growing up in Minnesota and Upper Michigan and Ontario, Canada. So I think I know what I'd be getting into. And, you know,
I've heard people say that before, haven't you?
Yes, and it's different now, winters. It's different. The bones don't take to the cold quite the way they did.
We've wept over their graves.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens with that plan.
We're going to wrap it up with a short piece, Edible Black Ink
Ink. Yeah, a collection of three little short pieces for electric guitar and bass.
That's it.
That's it. Nothing more to say. Completely through composed. Unlike repetition and variation, these pieces have nothing to do with repetition and variation. And that might be why they're so short, is they're completely just through composed pieces. In all three movements, I composed the entire bass line first, and then recorded the bass line and composed the guitar part over the bass line.
I've heard that done before.
Yeah, it sounds
familiar. It's a viable technique.
Yeah. Mozart did it, I'm sure.
Who?
Art Jarvinen, thanks so much for joining us on the brand new Calvos and Damien. You've been in the house with us today.
Yeah.
What house?